Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, February 24th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, search underway for missing 84-year-old Whale Gulch resident. Eureka Police report on surveillance and military equipment. And California lawmakers look to block ice near schools. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. A joint search and rescue operation is currently underway in Mendocino County's most remote community, Whale Gulch, where 84-year-old David Taylor has been missing for nearly 3 weeks. Taylor, a resident of what locals call the Yellow Dirt Road near the 7700 block of Usall Road, was last seen on February 6th. However, he was not reported missing to the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office until late last week, prompting the deployment of the Southern Humboldt Technical Rescue Team and law enforcement officials from both Humboldt and Mendocino counties. Captain Quincy Cromer with Mendocino County Sheriff's Office provided the latest details to our newsroom this Monday afternoon. Captain Cromer noted that Taylor lived alone and had recently suffered a medical emergency, receiving assistance from the Whale Gulch Volunteer Fire Company.
This person is well known to locals there in Whitethorn and known to the point that people will check on him because it sounds like he lives alone and has lived alone for some period of time. So the Whale Gulch employee from the fire had met with him, and it sounds like Dave may have had some medical condition on the 5th, and that caused this fire, Whale Gulch fire personnel to take Dave to the hospital in Garberville for medical treatment. I don't know if they stayed there with him or picked him up afterwards, but they came home that night on February 5th and drove Dave all the way to his house on Usall Road. And then the next morning went and picked up Dave again from his residence, drove him to the Whitethorn post office, realized that Dave forgot the keys, went back to Dave's house, drove him back to the post office, and that's the last time 100% confirmed that Dave was seen was at the Whitethorn post office, which is actually in Humboldt County, was sometime during the morning of February 6th.
There has been a recent development in the investigation following the Shelter Co. General Store sharing security footage, potentially showing the vehicle the missing man was last seen parking.
Shelter Cove, where we had some footage of a car that definitely resembles and has been identified by other people to be associated with Dave, but we just can't 100% unequivocally guarantee that is his vehicle because you can't see anybody get out of the car and you can't see into the car to see that it's Dave driving it. But with it being such a remote area and a very unique vehicle, we think this is like a 90s model Nissan Pathfinder two-door. It looks like it's tan or silver in color, a lighter color, that we do believe it to be Dave. We just can't say, like I said, unequivocally that it is him because he doesn't get out of the car, you can't see into the car, and you can't see the plate.
Captain Cromer noted that the footage shows the vehicle pulling up to the general store and parking. However, no one was seen exiting, making a positive identification difficult and adding to the investigation's challenges.
We're having a difficult time trying to figure out the vehicle license plate for this car because it's not registered to Dave. And it's our belief, and Humboldt County Sheriff and Humboldt County CHP that's assisting on this, and the other fire departments up there that know Dave, that that is a vehicle he is driving and has been seen driving and is associated with. We just don't know who owns it or who it's registered to figure out what the license plate is. So that's been a little bit of a hurdle to figure out what the license plate is, but we're going to ask anyone that sees a car that matches that to just report it so we can go pursue that and investigate to see if it is associated with Dave or not.
Captain Cromer says that while MCSO is working diligently to piece together the evidence to locate Taylor, the investigation is running 3 weeks behind, since the initial call was received last week.
So there was some time that passed. You know, you're talking 2 weeks that he was seen on the 6th, and it was, you know, two Tuesdays later when it was reported to us that he was missing. So we had no knowledge of him being missing. And obviously, in a missing person investigation with an 84-year-old male, time is of the essence. So from talking to people that associate with Dave, it sounds like he had made mention or frequented the area of Paradise Road or Honeydew Road, which are all also in Humboldt County. So we've shared that information, obviously, with the Southern Humboldt Technical Rescue Team, who has been very involved in this case because there's a lot of searching going on in Humboldt County, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, who we've been in contact with, and the Humboldt County CHP that work out of that area. And everybody's looking for that vehicle and has been checking the main roads between Shelter Cove to the post office to his residence, and anywhere in between, and nobody can find that vehicle. So as of right now, we have no idea where Dave is or where to even search for him other than the main roads, because we have no evidence that he left that area. So that's the main effort right now. So I know that the Bryceland and Whale Gulch Fire Departments, Humboldt CHP, and Humboldt County Sheriff are all frequenting those roads along with a bunch of residents and friends or acquaintances of Dave's to see if they can find that car, because that's going to obviously lead to a more narrow area that we can deploy search and rescue and other resources to go search more thoroughly.
He noted that David Taylor experienced a medical emergency the day before he was last seen, so we asked whether his disappearance might be connected to that incident, perhaps indicating that he left the area to be with family, or if it suggests that something more serious may have occurred.
At this point, we're considering anything is possible. I think it would be closed-minded to say that he couldn't have left. He obviously could have physically left if he had access to that vehicle and he was seen with that vehicle at the post office. It doesn't seem like that's something that Dave would commonly do in talking to the locals. Like, even when he needed to go to the hospital, obviously he was having a medical situation, but people would take him there because it's Garberville and it's a longer drive. So I don't know if he frequently leaves the area or not. I don't know him, and I haven't established that with people that do know him if he did leave the area frequently, but we're considering anything an option. And once you make it out to 101, I don't know about Humboldt County, but if you were to go south, we do have license plate cameras that might capture that vehicle, which is pretty unique. So we're pursuing that angle as well. And another thing we are considering, and we've reached out to the Highway Patrol, we don't have any in-county resources for a helicopter or fixed-wing aircraft to search from the sky. So we're reaching out to CHP, which is primarily out of Reading, who is the most local asset to do overflight searches for us, with the understanding that there's some weather conditions up there today that would prohibit any type of air searching, and also with the understanding that there's some very thick and high canopy in that area that might prohibit seeing a car along the roadway, depending on how many openings there are along the roadway. But we will still try that, because we'll try anything to see if it works at this stage, to see if we can find that car and then do some more focused searching in that area.
Although the missing man was a resident of Mendocino and was last seen in Humboldt, the MCSO captain says that jurisdictional complications are not hampering the investigation.
Everything right now is collaboration and cooperation. Obviously, everybody coming from Humboldt is a lot closer than us. That area is covered by the Willits office, so that would be the north sector of our jurisdiction. And from the office in Willits, we're talking upwards of, you know, roadways and weather conditions permitting 4 hours of a response time to get there. So that's where we are working collaboratively and cooperatively with Humboldt County Sheriff, CHP, and the local fire departments that know that area better than we ever will. And it is like an island. For us to respond there, more often than not, we go up to Redway, we head west like we're going to Shelter Cove, and then drop back down into Mendocino County. So it is one of the most remote areas of our entire county, and it takes a long time to respond there. That's why, as of right now, we are relying on the locals and the CHP and SOs, up the sheriff's office up there in Humboldt, because they know that area, and he was last seen in Humboldt County. So as far as jurisdictions go, he was reported as a missing person to us. There is no timeline on a wait period of anything on a missing person, especially somebody that's 84 years old. We will take that report immediately, and we did when we were notified numerous weeks later. But at the end of the day, time is of the essence in these types of cases. So there is a concern that he has not been seen or heard from for over 2 weeks now. We're almost at 3 weeks. This week will be 3 weeks that he has been not seen.
Residents in Whale Gulch, Whitethorn, and Shelter Cove are advised to exercise caution on roadways due to an increased presence of law enforcement and search and rescue personnel conducting surveys and searching the area. David Taylor is described as an 84-year-old white male standing between 6'5 and 6'6 tall, weighing approximately 185 pounds. He has white hair and brown eyes. Witnesses report that he was last seen wearing multiple layers, including jackets with a dark brown and maroon plaid pattern, a dark-colored beanie, blue jeans, brown boots, and reading glasses.
So he is described as a tall and slender man and had that full white beard, and the beard was very unkempt and untrimmed. The vehicle we believe he's associated with, based on witnesses and in the footage we think is a match of his vehicle, is what we believe to be a 90s model Nissan Pathfinder two-door. So it's an SUV-looking vehicle, but it's you know, upwards of 30-some years old if it's a 90s model. And it looks to be tan or silver, a very light color, from the footage we got from the Shelter Cove General Store.
Captain Cromer urges anyone with information to come forward, emphasizing that no tip is too small.
So if anybody sees something, or even if they have information they may not think is pertinent, let us be the judge of that. Please call the Sheriff's Office at 707-463-4086 and press option 1 to get to dispatch. Any information, no matter how, you know, minor it may be to them, it might be important to help us figure out where Dave may be and where his vehicle is at, so we can do a more thorough search of that area. So if you know something or you believe you have information that might assist us, please call.
Again, the number to report any information on the possible whereabouts of David Taylor is 707-463-4086. A photo of the missing man, along with the vehicle law enforcement believes he was last seen in, can be viewed at kmud.org. At its latest meeting, the Eureka City Council fielded annual reports on police surveillance, weaponry, and operations. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Eureka has added 3 surveillance trailers to its policing toolbox, and this year the city's police department will purchase 5 new patrol rifle systems and 5,000 rounds of ammunition. At its February 18th meeting, the Eureka City Council fielded annual reports on the police department's use of surveillance cameras and military equipment. City Police Chief Brian Stevens said cameras are used by the police to deter and record crimes, and in 2022, the city contracted with the Live View Technologies company to station cameras near what he called high-traffic areas and high-asset city property. But last year, the city largely shifted from use of stationary cameras to mobile cameras mounted on trailers. They're set up in areas prone to vandalism, trespassing, and other crimes at what Stevens called problematic locations, often in response to complaints. Stevens explained how the trailer cameras, known as lot cops, have been used.
They've been used on city property as well as the request of business owners to address problems they're having at or near their businesses. Historically, locations identified were by complaint or city staff through the SEPTED process when we would go out and visit businesses and address their issues that they were having. Cameras are used in a proactive policing model when the city hosts large public events such as concerts and festivals such as the 4th of July. You would have seen it down there at 2nd and D. The trailers are a deterrent to criminal behavior and quality of life issues. When we place a trailer at a problematic location to address specific behavior, we see an immediate change in positive outcomes. In September 24 of 2024, numerous reported and unreported damage to new and remodeled city facilities, Carson Park to be exact, 2 documented felony vandalisms resulting in thousands of dollars of damage. A lot cop was placed there near the end of September, and since then there's been no damage to the city facility. Right here at City Hall, city vehicles that were parked near City Hall were suffering drilled fuel tanks. A total of 10 city vehicles were damaged. Each cost to repair roughly $1,000 plus $100 in loss in fuel. That was up to right before Christmas, where we placed a lock cop there right before Christmas of 2024. And to date, we've had no other vandalisms reported in that parking lot to any city vehicles.
The cost of the city's contract with Live View, which now includes 4 trailer cameras and 1 stationary camera, is $96,000 a year. Stevens said there are no plans to add more of them. Military equipment reporting is required by a 2021 state law and city policy. But Stevens clarified that the department doesn't have any military equipment, and he's reporting on equipment considered standard gear to be transparent. The department has 38 semi-automatic patrol rifles, Stevens said, which can be used in anticipation of an armed encounter to meet or exceed a suspect's firepower and deal with barricaded suspects. Stevens said his officers have deployed rifles this year, but didn't have to fire them. The department is also equipped with 7 pepperball launchers and is converting 3 shotguns into less lethal beanbag shotguns. The use of the weapons was described as infrequent, as discussed in this exchange between Councilmember Scott Bauer and Stevens.
Over the past 10 years, how many times have we had to, discharge one of those weapons? What would you, just roughly?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a couple of officer-involved shootings that the rifles have been used in. I can think of one particular case with an individual that was charging down a trail toward officers who were in pursuit of him. There was other officers staged on the trail, at which point he was holding a knife. They discharged a less than lethal shotgun, beanbag round, stopped his assault or stopped his path that's kept him from having to shoot him. The pepperball launchers have been used at least once in that crowd control environment that we were in when we were getting assaulted. And then other times when you can introduce an OC device into a circumstance to evacuate people who do not want to be evacuated, such as you have a felony suspect hiding in an attic, and instead of me sending officers up into this attic where they can't see, we can deploy the munitions up there, create a circumstance where the becomes very uncomfortable for somebody to be up there and try to convince them then to comply with our orders and peacefully surrender. So that has happened probably 2 or 3 times that I'm aware of.
I just bring that up really, I kind of know the answer. I mean, people like to talk about the high crime rates, but I think you just made it pretty clear. We don't really have that bad of a situation.
In this exchange with Stevens, Councilmember Leslie Castellano asked about the use of the chemical launchers.
As someone who attended a peaceful solidarity gathering yesterday, I think there's a lot of folks who are, kind of concerned about, whatever your political beliefs. But I guess I was just curious about how riotous behavior is defined.
It's a very strict set of guidelines that we could deploy those type of munitions in. The one time that I have seen it deployed in an environment like that was in 2020, I believe it was, when officers were actively being assaulted as we were trying to make an arrest. They were used to create space and to back off those that were causing the assault to allow us to get back to our vehicles. But that it truly has to be something above and beyond a peaceful demonstration. There has to be acts of felony, either vandalism, violence toward the officers or to others that needs to be stopped immediately to save lives or to stop injuries.
An annual report on police operations included crime statistics from 2023 to 2024, what the report calls crimes against person in Eureka increased by 1.83% from 873 incidents to 890. But crimes against property saw 11.56% decrease from 1,523 incidents to 1,347. In 2024, Eureka Police made 2,536 arrests. The majority, 1,705, were misdemeanor adult arrests, and there were 811 felony adult arrests. Stevens noted overall staffing progress, saying there's been, quote, significant strides in recruitment, filling vacancies, and increasing staffing to levels we haven't seen in years. But he noted that the department's patrol division and dispatcher team remain short by 3 officers and 3 dispatchers. Council members praised the department's work, and City Mayor Kim Brigel said it has noticeably improved, crediting police with, quote, the desire to make so many connections within our community. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In tonight's County Conversation, we speak with Humboldt County Supervisor Natalie Arroyo, who represents the 4th District, including the cities of Eureka, Fairhaven, and Samoa. Typically, we check in with the supervisor on the 4th Monday of each month. However, this interview was recorded last week after she learned that she would be deployed by the Humboldt Sector Coast Guard to respond to the LA wildfires. Supervisor Arroyo, thank you for joining us. Last time we spoke, it was just hours before your healthcare town hall forum. While KMUD has highlighted some key moments from the event, could you summarize the forum for our listeners and share your most important takeaways from the discussion?
Well, I would say it was a really successful event. We had nearly 200 people watching the live stream, and you know, more than 150 people who attended in person. So it was a really productive conversation. So I started with a presentation about my my research into the topic of healthcare provider recruitment and retention. So specifically thinking about, you know, doctors and advanced care providers in our community. That's a topic I hear, you know, a lot of concern about from constituents. So I dove into that. So I gave a summary of what I'd found, but the real key feature was the a panel of CEOs of local hospitals and healthcare institutions and our public health officer and some other fine folks who are really knowledgeable about provider recruitment and retention. And so they, you know, they shared what they're doing. I think the best part about it, I think, for community members was just being able to put a face and a name together and understand who these people are and kind of what they're doing in their communities. I don't think that everyone who lives in Humboldt is as familiar with the variety of institutions that we have here and what they do. So that was I think the biggest takeaway. I mean, we are struggling as many rural communities are struggling. So I don't know that there was one particular thing that we can do differently, but it's certainly the beginning of, I think, a meaningful conversation and an opportunity for me to engage and other elected officials to engage with the healthcare sector on an ongoing basis.
St. Joseph Hospital has been at the center of multiple protests lately, healthcare workers demonstrating over staffing issues and community members raising concerns over its reproductive healthcare policies. Given that St. Joseph operates as a nonprofit under the umbrella of Providence Healthcare, a conglomerate, how do you navigate these complex challenges in a small rural community like ours?
Well, I mean, I want to start by saying those are really important issues to me. The gender-affirming care and reproductive care that all of our institutions provide is critically important, and it's required by law in California, and it's expected by our community. As far as how, you know, the approach that our local institutions are taking to this, I want to urge them to do the right thing by the law and by their patients. And it's an area where I have very little direct influence. So I am trying to add my voice to the community voices saying, like, please do the right thing. And as far as the upcoming, you know, actions that are planned, you know, I support the right of workers to organize. And again, I'm not really in a decision-making role and have no direct influence there, but I do want to urge that the, you know, community members who work there exercise their rights, and that's what they're doing. And I really greatly appreciate that. This is a moment in time where I want to see, you know, civic engagement and discourse be respected and upheld, and the rights of people to protest continue to be upheld in our country and in our communities. So I urge them to make their voices heard.
Shifting to broader public health concerns, it has been exactly 5 years since Humboldt County confirmed its first case of COVID-19. Amid growing concerns over avian flu, what key lessons has the county learned from the pandemic, and how is the Department of Health and Human Services preparing if bird flu becomes a more serious public health threat?
Well, we have a pretty phenomenal public health department. So I have to say our public health officer has been keeping us informed regularly of, you know, what's been happening with the avian flu and what, you know, what measures we're taking for detection. So working with, you know, our public health team and environmental health down the line, should that become necessary to, you know, do ongoing monitoring of, you know, they can detect essentially viral loads from wastewater treatment, things like that. So there's some detection options that are available to us there as well. So We'll continue to monitor it. I will say, we did a great job of getting information and vaccines out. There was also a really active disinformation campaign about that was inaccurate about the safety of that. Those like medically available treatments and options that were free to our community members. And I will say that I have grave concerns that as we move forward with the national landscape of public health, that that will continue to be that inaccurate narrative will continue to be out there. So I think it's our job to continue to provide accurate information and face time with folks like our public health officer, so people learn to get to know her and trust her. And that's a big part of why she was part of the panel discussion I hosted. And she's, a very direct and likable person. So hopefully, as folks get to know her, they will trust that source of information. We will continue to monitor the situation and make sure that our community knows what's going on if we have any hits at all, and knows how to keep themselves safe.
By the time this reaches our airwaves, you will have been deployed to serve in another California county. Can you share what information you're able to about this role and what it entails?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a Coast Guard Reserve officer, which means that I can be activated for short-term deployments as needed by the service. So I will be going down to Los Angeles County in response to the fires. And I won't be able to share too much more about the specifics of my mission and location. And honestly, I don't know them yet. I just know the broad strokes of what I'm doing to help. So I'll be going down there for a few short weeks, less than a month. And that will put a little pressure on my fellow board members to help, kind of fill my spot for a short period of time and our staff. But everyone's been very understanding and helpful so far. And, once in a blue moon, this does happen. When I was on the Eureka City Council, I went to the East Coast to help with an oil spill response to a major disaster there for about a month. And so once in a while, it does happen, and I'm able to, help out. So I will say, in response to the LA fires, I know our community and all communities around the state have had an outpouring of support for our neighbors to the south. And so I'm glad that I'll be able to, to assist them.
Any other additional updates or messages you would like to share with the public?
Well, our board did just sign, did just agree to sign a memorandum of understanding about the Eel River and Russian River as we move forward with the process of dam removal on the Eel, or I should say as PG&E moves forward with that process. So we did unanimously decide this week to support an agreement that limits the diversions from the Eel to the Russian River watershed to the wet weather season only. It really steeply curtails the amount of water diverted, and it ensures that there's restoration funding for the Eel to ensure, environmental restoration of that watershed. So I think, it's not maybe the ideal outcome in everyone's view, but I'm happy with it, and I think it'll help dam removal move forward expeditiously, which is the most important thing in my book.
Thank you, Supervisor Arroyo. We appreciate you joining us for our monthly County Conversations check-in and wish you the best on your assignment in LA.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That was Supervisor Natalie Arroyo speaking in our monthly segment, County Conversations. You can catch our check-in with the 4th District Supervisor on the 4th Monday of each month. In state news, California lawmakers look to block ice near schools. Alex Gonzalez shares this report.
Last year, Democratic State Senator Elena Gonzalez introduced Senate Bill 48. The legislation would block immigration enforcement from happening near schools. It would also seek to keep California's status as a sanctuary state, which is also one of the things on President Trump's chopping block. Data shows that more than 1 million U.S. citizen children in the state live with at least one undocumented family member. Kristen Rao Finkbeiner with the social welfare group Moms Rising says they're hearing from folks and students around the country who say Trump's directives are inciting fear in children and families. Families that could have short and long-term consequences.
A terrified child in a classroom full of fearful children can't learn or thrive, and that creating a climate of fear at schools harms every child. We will demand that our government acts humanely and with compassion.
I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz and Alex Gonzalez. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.